The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Giant jet aircraft had designers. So did computers, radios, television sets, automobiles, and even doorknobs. But did fish? Did birds have a designer? And did you have a designer? Did somebody design the human hand, the human eye, the human ear, the human skeletal structure and muscular system and nervous system, the human mind, and make it different and superior to animal brains? Or did all this just happen as a result of blind chance and random happenstance, disorder, chaos, over a long, interminable period of time? You know, this caused even one of the most noted of all evolutionists, Julian Huxley, to ponder how can blind chance produce design? Let me show you the way he reasoned it out. He said, how can a blind and automatic sifting process like selection, operating on a blind and undirected process like mutation, produce organs like the eye or the brain with the almost incredible complexity and delicacy of adjustment? How can chance produce elaborate design, he asked. In a word, are you not asking us to believe too much? Well, that's a good way to put it, I think. Yes, the answer to that would be at any convention where people are gathered together looking over this new neo-Stone Age religion, this ancient paganism in the guise of modern tuxedos acceptable in the halls of science and among noteworthy people of degrees and certain, accomplishments in their past lives, especially in the academic field. When somebody asks me a question like that, can chance produce elaborate design? You know, do explosions in print shops produce books, as I've asked? And do aircraft crashes produce brand new aerodynamic principles, I have asked? And do toppling bricks off a cliff result in five-room homes with a key over the door? And do monkeys at a typewriter produce encyclopedias? And people ask a question like that if we were having some kind of a convention to decide the issue, maybe like a brand new scope trial or something. This time the evolutionists were on trial instead of the religionists, and they came along and told us that the eye, the brain, the ear, the remarkable prowess and properties and abilities of intricately designed insects, animals, fish, and even man, that all this could happen by blind random happenstance, by a series of fortuitous accidents, by blind chance. They say, are you asking us to believe too much? I would say, oh, you bet you are. You're asking me to believe absolutely aeons and universes too much. It's just impossible that anybody could ever believe such a thing as that. Now, you can back off and respect their faith. The same way if I were visiting that new Stone Age tribe they found down there in southern Mindanao in the Philippines, and I watched their pagan superstitions, and they really believed that God was in a leaf or a bug. Well, I would stand back there and kind of wait and watch them, but I would feel a kind of a mixture of pity, of understanding, I hope of compassion, and maybe even a certain measure of curiosity mixed with a certain measure of admiration of how can anybody continue to live in such poverty, such filth, such squalor, and such ignorance, and not be gradually emancipated from it by an understanding of some proportions better than thinking the God they worship looks like a bug. So maybe you would have those emotions, at least those are some of the emotions I have about evolutionists, who can still say, asking such an eloquent question, say the following. How can chance produce elaborate design, he asked. In a word, are you not asking us to believe too much? The answer, he said, is no. No, all this is not too much to believe, he said, once one has grasped the way the process operates. But nobody's ever done that yet, you see, because nobody knows how the process of evolution operates. Now, I'll show you this by taking a look in a few moments at something that is going to be very, very interesting to us, because I am now in proof number 5. Now, on this series, I've been going through 7 absolute, incontrovertible proofs. Not suggestions, not perhapses or maybes, not questions, not something for further thought. Oh, no. No tangible proof that God does exist and that there is no answer other than the fact of a divine creator God. The Bible says, prove me now herewith. It says, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. It says, that which may be known of God is evident to them, even pagan philosophers and people who are agnostics who don't want to believe it because of an ingrained anti-God, anti-supernaturalistic, anti-miracle bias that people have. They want a scientific, that means usually a mundane, earthy, physical explanation, even for spiritual things. They just don't want to believe there is a God. Why? Well, because they don't want to be told that they ought to obey that God. They don't want to keep his laws. They don't want God bothering their conscience. So people come up with all sorts of excuses not to believe in God. You know, another very leading evolutionist, George Gaylord Simpson, talked about machines being designed as if someone had a purpose in mind. He said, and I quote, a telescope, a telephone, or a typewriter is a complex mechanism serving a particular function. Obviously, its manufacturer had a purpose in mind, and the machine was designed and built in order to serve that purpose. An eye, an ear, or a hand is also a complex mechanism. It's rather a poor comparison in one sense of the word, because really there is no comparison between a human hand and a typewriter. A human hand is so marvelously and intricately superior to any typewriter, any collection of 1,000 of them, there is no comparison. But he draws the analogy anyhow, and he says, an eye, an ear, or a hand is also a complex mechanism serving a particular function. It, too, looks as if it had been made for a purpose. Design, intricacy of design, interdependability of living creatures, the web of life in the earth and in the sea, all of these living things around us, all designed for special purposes and for interrelating and interdependent purposes, so that if you take away one and he does not fulfill his function, or that plant doesn't fulfill its function, the whole food chain collapses and nobody survives. Without bees, there wouldn't be plants and edible vegetables and fruits, and we wouldn't be here, which came first. But he went on to say, but now we know that evolution is a fact. We can no longer accept the simple solution of the problem of adaptations as reflecting the purpose of the Creator manifested in the separate creation of each species of animal or plant. Whether or not we can explain the evolution of adaptation has no necessary bearing on the truth of evolution. How would you like to worship at an altar where the religionist says, whether or not I can explain this doctrine to you has no bearing on whether you ought to accept it? How about a good, brand new political party platform? Let's all get on the bandwagon and say, yay, let's ram that one through. Whether we can explain this to the public or even ourselves has no bearing on whether we're going to ram this through as a platform and make the voters swallow it. Whether it's palatable to the average person or not, whether we're talking about raising taxes or lowering wages, we know that we're going to believe it anyhow. Now that sounds to be a little bit irrational somehow to me. So on this series of programs, I have been giving incontrovertible proof. Proof number one, to rehearse it quickly, is that law requires a lawgiver. And I'm talking about immutable laws that govern the entirety of the universe, not just laws that men legislate. Law requires a lawgiver. Life requires a life giver. And we see a giant creation that does exist all around us. Matter, the existence of things, and that there was no past eternity of matter, and that requires, absolutely demands, a creator. Creation demands a creator. That's proof number three. Fourth, you see that kind reproduces after its own kind, that there is a way that life operates, that the creator God who made it that way has sustained it that way, that kind reproduces after like kind. Humans give birth to humans, and cows to cows, and chickens reproduce chickens. It never gets mixed up, no matter what the comparisons we see in comparative, perhaps anatomy or comparative embryology. And all you're doing in the world there is lining out a whole series of living creatures and saying they all had a common designer. Which brings us to proof number five, that design, intricate design, requires a designer.
There's one question that has bothered man for centuries, but it probably has bothered you also. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, but it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a spiritual God. Everyone has an opinion, but how many have the facts? There's no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. write for your free copy of Does God Exist? Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.
Everything around us is the result of intricate design. I talked recently about the bats and their ultrasonic kind of radar by which they can not only identify objects, whether they're soft-bodied like an insect or hard like a wall, they not only navigate, but they actually capture their food this way. But you know, in nature, there's so many fantastic things, like a kind of a pecking order among fungi even, like the Galapagos plant needs a turtle in order to germinate. How the weaver bird's mysterious nest-building instinct, the water ouzel or the dipper, maybe you've seen them along streams, how the bird is as much at home there underwater as in the air, and also a beetle that uses a detergent to sink a water-walking enemy. A rattlesnake has an infrared homing device. Beetles have artillery and engage in chemical warfare. Moths have a kind of an ultrasonic early warning system. Little creatures that do things that computers can't even do, how did it all get started? This is what I like to do when it comes down to the question, if evolution could be true, which it can't, to any rational thinking human creation, when it begins to really think about it, then if evolution could be true, how can it? If you're the end result of evolution, why can't your mind easily see, with no big difficulties, how you could have evolved from protoplasm, from a blob, or from an offshoot of maybe Homo sapiens and some of these characters running around the world years ago that were dragging their knuckles on the ground and beating women over the head and dragging them off into caves and so on. I want you to take a look, then, at one of the most amazing critters on the face of this earth, a little archer fish who swims about in the brackish swamps, coastal waters, and freshwater brackish swamps of Southeast Asia and the northernmost tip of Australia. Because this little creature, the archer fish, is one of the most amazing in existence. It's only one example out of more than 1,300,000 cataloged species in the earth. The archer fish has binocular vision just like a human, great big eyes, he rises up, he sees the bug, and then he squirts real quickly, bang, and there it is. Oh, it's something the fish does commonplace. You can buy one. You can have one at home, in your own little aquarium, if you would like. I know a lot of people who have. I've never got one for mine yet, but I remember a case where a man who was studying this species of fish called Jaculatrix of the Toxotes, as a family name, was at night, I think, approaching the tank and lit a cigarette, and the little fish spit him right in the mouth and put the cigarette out. And we were just talking to one of the cameramen here, Jim Jensen, before time, and he's got one or had one, and the thing took a pot shot at his eye when he approached the tank too close. So there are more than 1,300,000 cataloged species of fish on this earth. And in every one of these 1,300,000 cases, there is a fascinating, interesting story of specialized design. In every case, there may be specialized methods of how they procreate and how they defend themselves, of coloration, of feeding habits, and so on. But there are five species of archerfish. The archerfish is the only one that spits to obtain food. But he doesn't have to. Now, why should this be a headache for evolutionists? Well, let's get down to it. Let me show you. As these little fish develop, with these great big eyes that are just like human eyes in the sense that they swivel forward. So they've got what we call binocular vision. You're looking through two different tubes, but you see it as one. Well, so does the archerfish. Whales don't. Chickens don't. Rabbits don't. They have a different kind of vision. But the archerfish has an unusual eye, an unusual number of cones and rods. That's what makes up the retina of the eye for opening it up and for focusing. And it is about 8 or 9 of the cones and about 217 of the rods because the cones are for daylight vision and the rods are for nighttime vision, when the insects are most likely to be hovering around underneath leaves above a kind of a brackish swamp. So why and how does this little fish shoot down his prey? As the tiny fish begin developing, they'll take a pot shot at insects only a few inches above the water. Maybe you can see them kind of gurgling away, but the older they get, the better they are able to spout this water out. It comes out in a steady stream, which was proved by the photography we did in our own science lab. So normally, the adult archer fish can shoot down prey on a leaf at a range of about 3 to 4 feet, but they have found out that it can go as far as 15 feet under some very strange conditions. But what makes this fish shoot down its prey? Ichthyology, a difficult word to pronounce. People who study fish have found a tiny groove in the roof of the archer fish's mouth. When the tongue, which is hard and bony, is compressed against that tiny groove with a mouth that is filled with water, and then a sudden snapping shut of the gill plate is brought about. Then a very accurate stream of water shoots out. Now, when you write for this brochure we're telling you about, you're going to see one of the most amazing pictures of candid photography that you could ever see. And really, even an explanation of how that was obtained is necessary, because we've had other organizations write in and say, could we please use that picture? It was a very painstaking job to get it. Stop action that showed just about the entire stream of water in midair, and it happened so fast that the eye can barely catch it. But to be there and to catch that by photography at the precise moment was really a tough job. You will see how the problem of the bending of light rays as they enter the water is solved in the picture that you will receive when you write for this brochure. Any boy who has hurled stones in a stream trying to maybe hit a fish or a crayfish or something like that has found very quickly that as that stone enters the water, he sees it seems to go to the bottom somewhere other than when he threw it, because the light bends as it enters the water. This fish has solved that problem. How? That's the question. Between the mouth and the eye, there's a certain measurable distance. The eye sees the target, but the mouth has to hit the target. That describes a kind of a triangle. That is the problem of parallax, which even gun directors and modern sophisticated aiming mechanisms for naval rifles and the like have to solve. The fish has it solved perfectly. No problem. How did that get solved? Let's take a look at it by admitting some of the problems that evolutionists have, and some that they admit they have in trying to solve the problem of spouting, of parallax, of all the other adjustments this little fish must make in order to obtain food in a way in which he does not need to obtain it.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's In the Home Educational Service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth, timely, informative articles, deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
Somewhere in the evolutionary scheme of things, there has to be room for the very first archer fish, the very first angler fish, the very first anableps, and the very first human being. Now, there are missing, massive, yawning gaps and huge chasms in the evolutionary theory, because all these supposed intermediate species simply do not exist, and there is no fossil record of them. There isn't a pre-archer fish found in fossil rocks. There isn't a partway archer fish found anywhere swimming the oceans of the world today. There isn't a partially developed archer fish. There is an archer fish, perfectly developed, doing perfectly what he does, but he doesn't need to. So let's think of 2 of the problems of evolution, which postulates that some of these genetic adaptations could happen over interminable periods of time out of a kind of a common genetic pool. It's like a fisherman going through his tackle box and selecting what he needs. And how this happened is rather vague. As a matter of fact, it's insane. But they believe it. Anyhow, the archer fish didn't need his special vision, his big eyes, with its unusual number of cones and rods in proportion to each other, if he weren't spouting jets of water high above his natural habitat at insects. He couldn't spout streams of water until he had the eyes. But he didn't need the eyes until he needed to spout. He couldn't spout the streams of water until he had that cleft palate. He couldn't use the cleft palate until he had the hard, bony tongue. But he couldn't develop the hard and bony tongue unless he needed to use it through the cleft palate. To snap those gill covers shut and to spurt that stream of water out there, we got to go back and imagine maybe the way we ought to do it is they say, well, what about the little pre-archer? The little baby archer for the first time. Maybe we can sit and daydream. We can imagine our minds. Maybe there was a time when the very first little archer fish, a would-be archer, was going along the surface and he kind of spit. And an insect fell in the water. Maybe he got bombed down by a passing bumblebee. And so the little archer fish kind of gurgled a few more spits, but he didn't have good developed eyes. He was looking out at both sides like most self-respecting fish, or to the rear or above, or like anableps, looking everywhere at once, because anableps is a fish that has four eyes, which we'll come to a little bit later on. That's a very, very interesting subject, and one which is a giant headache for evolution. How, then, could this special mechanism have been adapted? Well, only if it were required for his survival, for his very salvation, for his continuance as a species. Now, there are millions of fish and thousands of species, but, you know, they're swimming all over the oceans and the bays and estuaries and rivers and lakes and ponds and streams, and they're swimming on the bottom and feeding there, in the middle, near shore, and feeding there, at the surface, and feeding there, and once in a while leaping free of the surface. Here's the point. All those fish are just surviving just fine, except for man's depredations and pollution. But leaving man out of the picture and his cantankerous human nature and desire to get, the fish would be doing just fine without it. They're surviving, and not a one of them needs to spit to survive. Neither does the archer fish need to spit to survive. He does so, however. How did he develop this remarkable ability? This is a headache for evolutionists, and they have a unique method of sidestepping the whole issue. I think evolutionists and politicians ought to get together because they begin to sound remarkably alike. Now, look at this one. This is a direct quote, and in researching this, we find that one of the most thorough and comprehensive reports on the archer fish available was written by an ichthyologist who devoted himself to extensive research, anatomical study, even through dissection of the eye and all the parts and the apparatus of the fish, and experimentation with living archers. He said, and I quote, "This," and that is the fact, the archer does not need to depend upon spouting for his food, "this raises an interesting question for evolutionary theory. Spouting, if it is so unimportant, can hardly have been a significant factor in the survival of the species or in selection and differentiation within the species." Now we come to the next statement in the article. Quote, following right after those words, "Leaving this question aside, it is true the archer fish does spout and knock down insects." Oh, thanks, I needed that. You know, oh, that was great. What an explanation. How could it possibly have developed such a fantastic, intricate mechanism unless it needed to survive? It doesn't need to survive because it doesn't need to spout. However, leaving this question aside, let us go on to something else. Well, why leave it aside? Well, why not? Because they can't answer it. If they didn't leave it aside, it would lead down avenues in which they do not wish to be propelled. It would lead to a kind of a forcing of the issue where circumstances make them come face to face with the question, could the little creature have had a designer? Did a superior intelligence, a superior mind, think out and plan and put together and create such a fish? Did the very first archer fish succeed in spitting down his prey? Or was it an unsuccessful failure for millions of years while they all died and none survived? No, that doesn't make sense because they did survive and they can survive without having a spit. So when you begin to take any one of the remarkable creatures that are all around us, that are a part of our environment, whether you're talking about an archer fish or anableps, which merely means four eyes, and I'll come back and do something on that because it's a fantastic little creature. You see him swimming along, and just like some professors, you know, that they, which is unkind, we shouldn't call people just because they wear glasses four eyes, but this little fish actually has four eyes, and he's looking above, watching outside the water, swimming along with the top pair just above the water, and the other two are looking around down below, which means a rather involved brain. You know, it's a good thing we don't have four eyes. We'd be going crazy. You'd accuse people of having eyes in the back of their head because they sensed something that was going on, but they don't really. You can part the hair and look if you wish. But there are fish that really do have four eyes. Now, you begin to ask, well, how did that evolve? How could such a thing that is so fantastic and so intricate have happened just by chance, by blind mutation? Remember, mutations are 99% ineffective. Basically, a degeneracy, about 1 out of 100, is any kind of an improvement. Oh, ecological adaptation? Of course I believe in it. Moths turning black because they exist in soot-laden areas? Of course it happens. Absolutely. There is infinite capability for variety as well as ecological adaptation, just like the snowshoe rabbit that turns white in the winter and brown in the summer. But it's still a rabbit. It's still a rabbit, you know. It just changes. Like horses that grow long hair for winter and same comment deer and anything else, and then shed it in the summer. And your dog will do the same thing all over the rug if you let him. So, There doesn't need to be all this speculation and blind, hazy, daydreaming guesswork about whether or not evolution is true. If we're willing to face the facts, if we're willing to look at facts and ask who, what, where, when, how, and why, and demand an answer, not say, leaving this question aside, let us go on to something more important. We got right to the point where we had to say, could there have been a designer? Intricate design demands a designer, and that is as much a proof of God as any of the other first four that I have been giving you. So write for this very humorous and interesting as well as scientific brochure that is called Some Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory. Just write for the Fishy Stories brochure, the Fishy Stories booklet, and it will show you some of the most interesting things you've ever read in all of your life. There's a story here about a clownfish, and there's a picture of him on the cover, a bright, beautiful picture, and it tells you the whole story of how that little fish can nestle right down in the tentacles of a sea anemone that would be absolutely poisonous and would either kill instantly, would shock, or would paralyze, or would just strangle, would grab and hold, and then gradually devour as these digestive juices worked on the hapless little creature, another kind of fish. But other fish swim along, these sea anemones will, in their tentacles, just grab them, just close real quickly. And here's this little clownfish, and he's swimming around in these sea anemone tentacles, and he's not harmed at all. He's got some kind of a substance on his body that is absolutely immune to the poisons that come out of the sea anemone. What do they call that? Symbiosis, don't they? Where one living creature has a direct relationship in which he helps another living creature of a completely different kind to survive. So here the clownfish will dart out from his deadly poisonous environment, a deadly poisonous environment of these tentacles of the sea anemone, to other little fish. And the little clownfish will grab other little fish, bring them back, and bits and pieces of the food will fall into the sea anemone. So the anemone benefits from offering a safe haven to the clownfish. On the other hand, the clownfish has a place for protection, because should another fish come into those deadly poisonous tentacles, he would be grasped immediately, paralyzed, and gradually devoured. But how did the little clownfish ever begin to evolve some kind of immunity to those deadly tentacles? The point is, there couldn't have been a halfway measure. The very first time a clownfish ever got away with it, he had to survive perfectly, because all clownfish live that way. Well, you'll see all of that. You'll see some of the most beautiful color photography you can imagine. You'll see and understand about anoplasts, the little four-eyed fish, about lungfish, and how could these creatures have possibly evolved. It's free of charge, a fishy story, the story of evolution. All you need to do is jot down, first of all, the call letters of the radio station to which you're listening, the name of the radio station, and then send your name and address to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. The name is Garner Ted Armstrong. As far as I'm concerned, you can write to GTA. I'll know who you mean. Until next time, this is GTA saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.